Well, there's more to the president's ineptitude than just the stats of from the Department of Justice on crime. When he says it feels inequitable in the communities of color. You know, the information as to whether or not it is inequitable justice, black versus white, as opposed to perpetration of crimes is one thing. Blacks are five times more likely to perpetrate crime. Blacks are 90% of the time that a black is killed by another black. You know when? And blacks are eight times more likely to be the perpetrator on black and white violence. But there's two other statistics we've talked about on this program. One is that a research study was done of every crime in America that was a violent crime. And what the research found is investigating hundreds of thousands of cases that if the case were similar, that a Caucasian was more likely to be convicted than the African American. There was a 10% difference. Same kinds of cases, same kinds of charges, same kinds of circumstances. The Caucasian was 10% more likely to be convicted. Now, if convicted and when convicted, the African American was given, on average, a 10% longer sentence. Now, the explanation of that could well be that since a lower percentage of African Americans are convicted, and most that when they are convicted, the evidence is so sure that the sentence is longer. But it could be just an anomaly. When you're dealing with 10%, those are not necessarily significant numbers. And Glenn, if I were to tell you that you could choose between having a 10% chance, lesser chance of being convicted, or receiving, if convicted, a 10% lesser sentence, which side of that equation would you prefer to be on?
The latter.
You'd prefer to have a 10% higher likelihood of being convicted, but with a
greater sentence.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, it's exactly right. So while there is an offset here, the offset is not equitable. Anybody with a right mind would choose the offset that favors the African American, which is 10% less likely to be convicted. So the president knows that. So there's no reason to talk about feelings when the facts are known. There is no injustice in this regard. Now, there is only one place where African Americans have a legitimate complaint to a point. And that is that while there are no statistics on it, I think it's pretty obvious that police more often will pull over a car filled with African American youths. If a crime has been committed locally, then they will a car of Caucasian youths. But the principal reason for that is that most crime, you know, five times per capita, is perpetrated by African American youths, and when there are witnesses, the perpetrators are described as such. So it's one of those things that if you don't want that to happen to you, clean up your act, and it won't happen to you.
And yeah, right. And it's interesting. I've heard people talk about speaking to residents of Ferguson, you know, who don't want, you know, did not want violence. You know, the people who live there did not want this. So, you know, and supposedly like what someone who spoke to some of these people said was that, you know, they knew he was and Mike Brown was a troublemaker, and they didn't want this. A lot of this violence was, you know, done by people who don't have to live in the community. They've been shipped in by organizers and given money and brought in on buses and,
right.
and all that sort of thing. I've even heard of Islamic components of this, like Farrakhan-affiliated groups and PLO. There are rumors of PLO involvement and stuff like that, but who knows? You know?
Who knows? I mean, what we do know is that there were that African Americans by the many hundreds rioted wrongly. I mean, it's there are times when I could not think of one where it would be appropriate to protest. This wasn't even a time where it was appropriate to protest, but they took their protest to riot, and they torched buildings, and they were so excited by what they did, they took selfies. You know, you see a guy with a hoodie taking a picture of another African-American with a hoodie, spreading out his arms, celebrating the torching of Juanita's fashion boutique.
Yeah, and this is just opportunistic criminality. That's what we have, arsonists and thieves, you know, taking the opportunity to engage in these activities.
Right.
You know, how in the world could there be any semblance of anything related to justice associated with torching and looting, a business owned and operated by an innocent entrepreneur?
Yeah.
You know,
that
has nothing to do with justice.
We left the last segment by talking about the disarming of the police. I would favor, my personal choice would be to honor the U.S. Constitution and allow American citizens to own and bear any weapon of their choice. All weapons and any weapons without restraint of their choice. You know, that's what the Constitution said. There's a reason for it, because when you have that, you don't need an established military. No one can invade and occupy your country. And it precludes the government from being all-powerful, as American government has become. So I would do that, but on the police side, I would diminish the number of federal police to almost zero. And then the FBI would be gone, the CIA would be gone, the firearms, alcohol, and tobacco would be gone. The Marshal's Office would probably be gone. The Secret Service would be gone. All the federal agents, gone. And then local police, I would disarm in the sense of immediately get the military hardware away from them. No automatic rifles, no mortar rounds, no armored personnel carriers. Get that stuff away from them.
What happens in Tel Aviv or in Bern, Switzerland, when a woman yells, "Help, rape," in a dark alley?
In
Tel Aviev, a bunch of guys lean out the windows with rifles and, you know, shoot the guy, you know.
Yeah. You almost never hearing the perpetrator of a heinous crime in Israel surviving the crime.
Right.
Yeah, they take care of business.
In countries where the adult male population can be called up for the military and has their own rifle at home, street crime is very much different.
Yeah, it's true. You know, Obama said that when you get the race of the police force to match the race of the community, that works. There's no indication that works. I mean, look at the Los Angeles Police Department, look at the Chicago Police Department, and they match the demographics, but look at the murders and the crime that is perpetrated there. It's horrible.
You want to do something that works. If you want to do something that works, you change the mindset of the people that are out there talking to the people. You could put me in any neighborhood in the entire anywhere in the United States for sure, and I'll be okay because I can deal with people. I can deal with people. I can talk to people. I don't.
Yeah. But part of the police mentality, and I want to speak on behalf of against the police right now, we have way too many police officers that are ex-military that have been trained to kill and to view the prey, their prey, as inhuman, and to glorify the kill. And when you watch them now in live action, screaming at people with assault weapons pulled, you know, lay down on the ground, spread your arms, you know, like, I mean, these revolting commands, and this idea that, okay, this big boy was coming at Wilson, and Wilson felt threatened, so because he felt threatened, his first response was to pull his gun. Now, there are a lot of ways that a police officer inside of his car can protect himself that don't require him to pull his gun. I think that should be a last resort, not a first resort.
Exactly, but it's not just this. You want a case in point to where pulling a gun should be your last resort? Go no farther than Ohio, where the 12-year-old kid was shot because he had a fake gun.
Right.
The cops there couldn't even figure out how to get a gun away from a 12-year-old kid. I don't care if that kid's 5 feet away from me pointing a gun at me. He's 12 years old. I can figure out a way to get the gun, get him to put the gun down.
At the very worst. I mean, after you, I mean, if you don't have enough ability to engage with people, to tell a 12-year-old to set the gun down, and aren't willing to do that, if your first response is going to shoot because it doesn't have the orange "I'm a fake gun" cap at the end of it, you ought not be in law enforcement.
Exactly.
You should not be licensed to carry a gun.
He's not much of a wimp. Yeah.
Right. You can't yell at him. You can't yell at him to where he'll put it down. He's 12 years old.
Yeah.
Well. Yeah.
You certainly should be able to reason with a 12-year-old. And if you are going to say, "All right, I've tried. I did everything I could. I fear for my life," flee. Flee the scene. I mean, that's when Officer Wilson had this guy come at him. Well, he pushed it back in the car, and he was lunging through the window of the car at him. Drive the car away.
Well, first of all, he was unwise or foolish for engaging while sitting in a vehicle in the first place. If he had driven bad, he saw which direction he was walking in. He should have set up his encounter in advance.
Correct. I mean, Wilson did a lot of foolish things. Did Wilson commit murder? No. Did he do lots of foolish things? Yes. And the big thing with cops is we need to change the mindset in the justice community that shooting is not the first option. Welcome back to Shattering Mess. One of the, as we consider the testimony of Wilson and what we heard from the spokesperson from Ferguson was that Wilson's testimony was the most discounted. Now, Wilson did not have to testify. He did not have to answer questions from the grand jury. In fact, it typically is uncommon for the person being considered for indictment to testify. But he voluntarily testified. And the reason they would have naturally discounted his testimony is the fact that, you know, he's the person they're considering indicting. But in the end, the only person, well, there were four people's testimony that was a perfect match for the physical evidence. Three African-American witnesses whose story was identical to Wilson's, and Wilson's testimony all matched the physical evidence. And so, it matters what Wilson had to say. He went on to say that he did not want to be knocked out or worse. He immediately grabs my gun and says, "You are too much of a," I'll use sissy since I don't know if I can say the kitty cat word, "to shoot me. So you are too much of a sissy to shoot me." Wilson said that's what Brown said, saying that he thought he would be shot when Brown dug the gun into the officer's hip. Again, doesn't have the gun, this doesn't happen. Wilson testified, I tried to hold his right arm and to use my left hand to get out, to have some type of control and not be trapped in my car anymore. And when I grabbed him, the only way I can describe it is I felt how small I was compared to him. I felt like a five-year-old holding on to Hulk Hogan. That's just how big he felt and how small I felt from grasping his arm. Wilson said that he managed to pull the trigger and the gun clicked twice without firing before a shot went through the window. Wilson said Brown stepped back and then looked at him with the most intense, aggressive face. The only way I can describe it is it looks like a demon. That's how angry he looked, and he comes back towards me again with his hands up. Wilson said that he covered his face and fired the gun again. He told the grand jury that he fired two shots in the car before Brown took off running, and he followed him. Wilson said when Brown stopped, he told him to get on the ground. He said he squeezed a series of shots when Brown kept coming toward him and put his right hand under his shirt and in the wristband of his pants. He said he fired another round of shots as Brown continued to gain on him, approaching Wilson as if he was going to tackle him. Just coming straight at me like he was going to run right through me. And then he gets about 8 to 10 feet away, and all I can see is his head, and that's what I shot.
You know, Yada,
go ahead.
Yeah, there's an interesting aspect. Is I've not heard anybody question, but we've heard of this phenomenon called suicide by cop, where people will put themselves. You're talking about him reaching his hand under his shirt and the waistband of his pants, almost obviously to feign the throwing of a weapon. And I have to wonder if he were feigning that idea while advancing on the policeman. I mean, it almost makes you wonder if there's a possible suicide by cop element here. Why would he do that when he knows it's going to get him shot?
It is quite common. There may be some truth to it here. It is far more common than you might think. The issue that I have here is that first of all, I have the issue of no gun, Brown's not dead. And while Brown is a thug, and while he was high, and while he was a thief, and while he had assaulted a smaller man already earlier that day, just minutes before, and now while he was swearing at an officer, resisting arrest, and being belligerent here, none of those are cause to be killed. But the fact is that once he then ran away, if I were Wilson, I would not have pursued him. I mean, why go from bad to worse? Wilson, everyone's still alive. Everybody still has their life. You know, if a guy gets away that robbed a convenience store, that's not good, but it's a hell of a lot better than you having to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
So at some point, Wilson got too charged up and just should have left him alone. As we continue through the testimony that was released last night, we find that Dorian Johnson's testimony does not square with the evidence. Dorian Johnson was the thug that went with Michael Brown into the convenience store to steal the cigars. By the way, they didn't go in because they like Swisher Sweets. That style of cigar, it's a very inexpensive cigar, and its diameter and length make it ideal for smoking marijuana. And it's used for kind of an intense marijuana high. So Brown's companion that day, Dorian Johnson, the co-thief, told the grand jury that he was stunned when Brown stole cigarillos from the convenience store and expected to be arrested while they were walking home. But Wilson drove on after originally telling them to get on the sidewalk, reversing his vehicle and coming back at the pair after they ignored his demand. After he pulled back, there was no more sidewalk talk. It was just nothing. It was just anger, Johnson told the grand jury. Well, Johnson's testimony is different than everyone else's. He said Wilson opened his door suddenly, striking Brown, then closed the door and grabbed Brown by the neck, and the two men engaged in a tug-of-war, holding on to one another's shirt and arms. As the two wrestled, he said that he heard Wilson say, "I'll shoot." Johnson said that he never saw Brown punch Wilson, and didn't think that he grabbed the officer's gun. Johnson described being in shock as he realized things were getting out of control. By the way, the forensic evidence shows that the gunshot to Brown's hand was at such close range that there is no question that Brown was grabbing for Wilson's gun. And that was the first shot fired. At the time, I couldn't open my mouth. I couldn't speak. I wanted to say, was for everyone to calm down. I'm still standing there, more shocked than ever, because I've seen all this escalating. I can't see or hear the cuss words. I can see and hear the cuss words. I can see the frowns on their faces getting more intense. After the initial shots were fired, Johnson said that he and Brown took off running. After Wilson shot again, he said Brown stopped running and turned to face the officer. Now, the problem with that is that there are no shots in the back of Brown, so he was not shot running away from the officer. Johnson was wrong. At that time, Big Mike's hands was up, but not so much in the air because he had been struck. He said, "I don't have a gun," but he's still mad. He still has his angry face. "I don't have a gun." And before he can say the second sentence or before he can even get it out, that's when the several more shots came. All right. Well, that is inconsistent with the testimony of the officer, of the eyewitnesses, who said that Brown ran back at the officer. Johnson was asked if Brown ran at the officer prior to the fatal volley. He insisted that he did not, although the eyewitnesses said that he did. The grand jury testimony includes the accounts of many witnesses whose names are not listed on the transcript. One testified that he was working in a nearby building and saw Brown leaning through the police vehicle window, and some sort of confrontation was taking place. He said a shot rang out, and Brown fled as the officer chased him, which Wilson should not have done, with his gun drawn. Bad idea. The witnesses said Brown stopped and turned, but never raised his hands. He said Brown ran towards the officer at full charge. That is your suicide by police officer. He ran at the officer full charge. I mean, at that point, there was no question that the officer was going to kill him. I mean, I don't like authority. I don't respect authority. And if a bunch of police officers came at me with their guns drawn and demanded that I put my arms out and then lay down face first on the in the dirt, I'm not going to do it. But for damn sure, I'm not going to charge a man holding a gun when I'm unarmed at point blank range. That's suicide. I mean, it's that's what not only Wilson said, the most credible eyewitness to the event affirmed the same thing, ran at the officer full charge. Folks in the African-American community that are protesting, if you are capable of reason, President of the United States, if you're even capable of being moral, this man is not a victim. We ought not feel sorry that Michael Brown is dead. He brought this on himself. The officer then fired several shots, but Brown kept rushing toward him, the witness said. Another witness said that she and her husband were visiting a nearby apartment complex when she saw the shooting. She said that after the first two shots were fired, Brown began running from Wilson's vehicle, but stopped, turned around, and started heading towards Wilson, who shot at him. When asked if it appeared to be Brown was approaching Wilson in a threatening manner, the witness said, no, he wasn't. I think he was stunned, honestly. He just kept walking toward the officer. He didn't stop. You know, once again, that may be the case, and that Wilson misread Brown. But even if the second testimony here is true, that's not what you do. You've been in a confrontation with an officer. You were shot in the hand, not fatal, not going to die from it, while in a fight with an officer, and then he's pursuing you, and he tells you to stop, and you turn and come towards him while he's holding a gun, and you continue to walk towards him, and you're larger than him, you're going to get killed. Now, I do have another issue here. That is that the feds are continuing their investigation on civil rights charges. That's moronic. There is a 0% chance that race enters into any of this. Not in what took place that day with the death of Brown and the lack of an indictment against Wilson. That has nothing to do with race. The fact that police shoot first and that their first option is their gun, that's not racial either. The fact that we have a nationalized police force in America and that it's indistinguishable from the military, that's not racial either. The fact that grand juries capitulate to the Department of Justice, which is routinely dishonest and fabricates evidence, 99.999% of the time, that's not racist either. But the riots were racist. The African-American advocates were racist. The president's speech last night was racist. It was it's a sad affair. Glenn, I know you're still there. I don't know if you're still listening, but if you've got a final comment on any of this, the buildings that were looted, the buildings that were burned, the eyewitness accounts and the testimony, the whole grand jury experience.
Well, the whole thing is messed from so many angles. I mean, I've heard some of the legal experts point out that technically the prosecutor didn't have to send this to a grand jury. He could have, indicted unilaterally if he wanted.
Correct.
And the thing that I'm going away, well, first of all, this isn't over. This is going to be ongoing yet again tonight, probably to some degree at least, perhaps not as bad as last night. But what I see here, what I'm seeing is the overarching pattern. Well, you know, having to do with this whole idea of disempowering local governments and state governments, concentrating power into the hands of the feds, and eventually into the UN involvement. I see this as I see race being used here, just as religion is used when they manipulate Islam and stuff like that. They use any sort of social movement to create chaos out of which they can bring their new order and impose, top-down control.
Yeah, I mean, that's what the president was lobbying for last night, was he says, I don't want this papered over. I don't want anyone to pretend this is over. And what he's lobbying for is more federal involvement, more federal control, a nationalized police force. Absolutely. An integration of the Department of Justice and his nationalized police force. That's what he is pushing for.
I think this has all been in play for this reason. There was a black man killed in the stairwell of a New York housing project over the weekend. The police opened the door. The man was standing there with a woman, and they just executed him. They just didn't engage in encounter. No hands up, no orders, just blam, blam. They didn't call an ambulance, and the guy was just dropped dead. And we haven't seen any. The police commissioner came out and spoke of it being lamentable and that the guy had done nothing wrong. But we don't see this movement built up around. This actually was, you know, a horrific crime, unprovoked crime and a shooting. But we don't see the movement. Why? It hasn't been selected to be, as I said, the organizer doesn't have the money fomenting it, hyping it up to create the situation.
Well, you know, you look at the situation in Cleveland where the 12-year-old boy had the fake pistol.
Right.
Didn't point it at anyone. Didn't ever point it at the police officers. Never spoke threateningly to anyone, and yet he was shot dead.
But that's straight out of the movie Die Hard, where Officer Al Powell shot a kid and wasn't able to draw his weapon, so he worked a desk job.
Now, so by the way, I do not know if the officer who shot the young boy, who was African American, was black or white. But
right.
If you want to have a case and you want to have a young man that you could rally around, it would be that one. And yet all of the elected officials in Ohio, what they're saying is we ought to be more careful in the way that we disguise guns. The situation in Cleveland, though, underscores the point, in fact, even in the articles on this, that the police department got a call from a parent in the park that said, you know, there's a kid here that's brandishing a gun. The gun could well be fake, but, you know, it should probably be looked at. And the police officers were dispatched without conveying the parent's comment that the gun could well be fake. All right, so you're going to a park, children are playing, where you have a report that a child in the park maybe brandishing a gun. The dumbest thing you could possibly do is to get out of your car with your guns at the ready, rounds chambered, ready to shoot. I mean, that's stupid.
You're going into a park, not gang territory.
Correct.
It's a park.
Yes. It's an open park. I mean, it's, you know, carousels, that sort of thing. Just an open park. And at that point, you need to have your first line of defense, your first strategy needs to be your wits. Let me talk to this young man. If he has a gun, let me have him give it to me. Let me talk him into setting it down. Your wits. Your second option ought to be a stun gun or a pepper spray device. Actually, that would be third and fourth. The second would be while you're trying to talk the kid into dropping the gun and just setting it down because he's a cute little 12-year-old, is why not have one of the other officers sneak up behind him?
Craig, why not just tell the kid to come over to you? Hey, come here, young man. Come on over here and let me, you know. Hey, do you have a gun?
I disagree. Scott, I disagree in the sense that I would suggest engaging him verbally from a distance of greater than about 50 feet. Get his attention first. See if he makes any, you know, dangerous moves.
Oh, yeah, by the way, he didn't. He didn't point his gun at anyone, much less the officer, didn't threaten anyone, and no verbal comments from the kid. And finally, the officer that shot him was 12 feet away.
That's ridiculous.
You know, let's just say that the 12-year-old kid actually had a real pistol. You know, the range of accuracy of a pistol. It's surprising. Most people don't know this. But if I were to give you a pistol, now I shoot 10 cans and targets with pistols maybe once a year. At 50 feet, chances are I'm going to miss you. And when I practice, and chances are I'm going to miss you at 50 feet. But a kid, if that is a real gun with his body mass and the recoil of that gun and the difficulty in pulling the trigger and chambering the round and all the kind of stuff that goes along with it, the odds of him successfully shooting and killing the officer at 50 feet is nil.
Right, exactly. That's why I said engage him at a distance.
Absolutely. So, that's what Scott was saying. Engage him at a distance.
Tell him to come
engage over. Engage him. Right. Come on over. But this idea that then when you know you can't tell, so you you shoot to kill. Come on.
Right.
It's a 12-year-old kid.
Right. Well, they had to have tests. Like, hey, if you're a psycho or if you're that much of a psycho or that much of a wimp, please don't become a cop.
Really? Yeah. Exactly. We're just like we're attracting the wrong people in the military. We're attracting the wrong people in the police department. And I'm a kind of guy that that every place I go, if there's anybody that's kind of standing around, I'll figure out a way to talk with them, and I'll engage everybody in conversation. And you'd be surprised as to how open cops will be about fellow cops. And I will tell you, almost universally, cops will tell me that they really don't like being a cop anymore because of the attitude of other cops and how they're doing all sorts of stuff they shouldn't do and being way too aggressive and far too many are in it for the power that it gives them. We've got a problem culture here. Is that to say every cop is bad? Nope. But a significant number of them are. And making lots of bad decisions. I mean, Wilson here made some really bad decisions. And, well, I don't think he committed manslaughter. He made some bad decisions. And we ought not be empowering that sort of thing. And this officer in Cleveland, oh, my God. I mean, he ought to be locked up and for a very long time.